Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. One of the new officially sanctioned student organizations on campus this year, this semester, has to do with autism. It's called Students for Autism Awareness. Autism is a disorder that unfortunately is spreading exponentially. Our guest today is a non-traditional student named Ed Evans, who started up Students for Autism Awareness, and we're going to discuss the subject and what people can do to greater understand this really perplexing condition. Thanks for being here today, Ed.
Thank you for having me.
What gave you the idea to start this organization?
Well, it was basically with the Autism Speaks organization come to the state of Tennessee. We saw a student organization as a way that the younger community could get involved with Autism Speaks, because with one in every 150 children being diagnosed with autism now, you cannot walk this campus without knowing someone that knows someone with autism.
Isn't Autism Speaks the organization that was started by the Wrights?
Bob and Suzanne Wright are the founders of Autism Speaks. That's correct.
Bob is the chairman, I believe, of former chairman of NBC before it was NBC Universal. Right. What kind of work is Autism Speaks involved with? Are we talking research, funding, services for children already afflicted, the whole nine yards?
Well, there's a great combination, and they keep expanding of what they're available to, or able to actually provide services for communities. Their primary source is biomedical research, is to reach out and find out what is causing autism, what are the signs, the symptoms, and how we can treat it. Because with no known cause, we have no known cure, naturally. So we're trying to find out at least how to make these children's lives a little bit more typical but through treatment and whatnot. But their primary cause is biomedical research. And they've just started recently a community grant program as to with anybody within the community that has started an Autism Speaks walk, chapter, or thing of that nature, is to reach out for the service providers, the daycare providers, the speech pathologist, anyone that provides service to autistic children and their families, is to allow them to apply for community grants through Autism Speaks, and therefore to broaden their scope of help for autistic families.
Now, you said you go across this campus anywhere and you can find people whose lives have been impacted by autism. The audience might find that to be a bit surprising, even though this is a large undergraduate population that we have here and a substantial graduate student population that we have here. How did you come to realize that, was it just through casual conversations with other students and professors, the depth and breadth to which autism has affected the campus community?
Well, with my own experience, I have two children that are on the spectrum. In knowing that if, you know, I myself have two, there's got to be more than me. And having spoken with a few individuals, and it seems like every place I go to have a conversation about autism, I find more and more that come out and say we have a connection, whether it's their brother, a sister, a cousin, somebody, they have a connection. And it is professors, students, adjunct faculty. I'm running into everyone everywhere on this campus that has a connection. There are actual students right now going to this school that are living with autism.
How so? How can one be explained to folks who might have misconceptions how one can be a high-functioning autistic person and go to a college or university?
There are on the spectrum, there's what's known as Asperger's syndrome, which deals more with social interaction and the child interaction with people, and not so much his learning capability. You'll find most autistic children are very, very intelligent. It's just they lack the ability to be able to communicate their intelligence. You'll find these students, they live, they're very intelligent on this campus. They just have a problem interacting, which was another reason why we started the student organization, is to give these students on this campus that are living with autism a place to come and feel wanted and understood.
What is the disconnect? What is the disconnect between the autistic person's intelligence level and their ability to communicate?
It once again, there's no known cause. We really don't know what it is. I've heard a lot of people say that autism is a social disorder, and that's not really the case. It's a neurological brain disorder. Social deficit is just one, you know, just one avenue of autism that affects the children and the adults with it. There's super intelligence trapped in their head. It's just a matter of getting it out. Is a lot of things with autistic children and families is just trying to find avenues for them to express it.
Do the autistic students on this campus who are enrolled here feel stigmatized? Is it comparable to, we have a lot of disabled students on this campus who are visibly disabled and some who are not visibly disabled, but disabled nonetheless. Dyslexic, for example, mm-hmm. Suffering from depression, for example. But we have visibly disabled students who use wheelchairs, who use guide dogs, who use canes, who use walkers, scooters, so forth and so on. Do the autistic students feel in any way stigmatized by society or by the people in their campus community because of their disorder?
The higher functioning autistic adults that we have here on this campus, you wouldn't know that they have autism unless you asked them. There's no outward sign with them as a wheelchair that's going to tell you that they're autistic unless you ask them. And the only way you're going to do that is notice that maybe their speech is a little different than yours. Maybe their facial expressions are just a little different than yours.
But you did mention that sometimes they have a socialization issue.
They'll isolate themselves a lot of times, and that's mostly due through overstimulation. Usually when an autistic child becomes overstimulated, they tend to shut down. There's behavior issues that rise from it. And the adults that are living with it have learned to kind of adapt to that. And a lot of times self-isolation is how they get through it. But we are, like I said, once again, the group is providing an outlet for these adults to come to the organization to feel welcome, you know, 'cause, you know, we don't want anyone across this campus to ever not feel welcome in our group.
How did you first suspect that your children might be autistic?
Well, our first son, Joshua, was diagnosed just after he was 3 years of age. We just knew something wasn't right. And he didn't make a lot of the milestones that normal children, and I say normal, so we, you know, we really ask, well, what is normal? Typical is the word we like to use mostly. He didn't crawl. He didn't cry. He didn't react to a loud sounds. So we thought right away, okay, he's deaf. There's some things going on here with our son that's not typical. So after, you know, months, we watched him and were concerned about him. And then we started taking him to doctors and started asking questions. And in the military 11 years ago, autism was a foreign word. They knew nothing about it, knew no services existed for it. So we were sent on a global trek, believe it or not, to find assistance for our one son, which took us all the way from Walter Reed to Dallas, finding out a diagnosis.
Facilities and specialists, are that hard to find?
They were 11 years ago. They're becoming more common now because autism is on the rise. Because just simply 10 years ago, 1 in 10,000 children were being diagnosed with autism, and now it's 1 in 150. So you do the math.
Right. Did having an autistic child give you and your wife any trepidation about having future children?
Well, that's where you're going to find a lot of autistic families with multiple children, is because by the time one child is diagnosed, you're usually 3 and 4 years into already one child. And in most families, you traditional families, you'll have children within a year to 2 years apart. So before you have a diagnosis on one, you have another child. Now that when you have one diagnosed, you fret that the next one's going to be diagnosed, which was our case. Our son, once he was diagnosed, we watched our other one like hawks to watch for the signs and symptoms. And he really didn't exude the same exact patterns as his brother, But years on, the behavior issues really start to rise in our younger son, Jacob, to the point to where it was uncontrollable. And we had to start seeking out therapists and treatment for him. And then just recently, within the last year, he was diagnosed as a high-functioning autistic child.
So since he is high-functioning, you have hopes for his future.
He is a super intelligent child. He never forgets a person he meets. He's never met a stranger. He's what I call my mini-me. Mm-hmm. When we go to our autistic meetings and whatnot.
This is a child who will not have to be institutionalized.
If he is, it's his own. You know, it'll probably be an institution we don't want to talk about because, you know, it'll have bars and, you know,
right.
Because of his issues. But he is not socially deficit to the point to where he will not talk to you. His issues are mostly on the learning scale. He has a lot of repetitive learning issues. His have to be repeated several times for him to in order for it to be ingrained in his brain.
What sorts of behavior issues does a parent encounter with an autistic child?
You'll have mood swings. You'll have sudden outbursts of anger, destruction of, you know, toys, destruction of anything they get their hands on. Very hard to console them. It's a wide range. Every child is different. I'm just speaking from my experience, what my children done. My youngest, I think what the point that really scared me the most in Jacob's young life was when he put his head through a window.
Oh.
And I thank God above that he came out of that with not a single scratch. And it was amazing because there was just glass everywhere around him, and I don't know how he didn't receive any kind of injury.
That is amazing. How do you deal with it? How do you cope?
Yeah, well, every parent has a different way to do it. My coping is what I'm doing right now is getting out into the public and letting the community know these parents also self-isolate themselves because they feel like they can't go out into the public because they're stared at. They don't know how their child's going to act from one moment to the next. And they are received kind of that way. Why don't you take your child, you know, go spank them or do this? And autistic children can't be disciplined that way. It's just not done. You'll find a lot of parents will self-isolate themselves and just deal with it that way. I found it very therapeutic to come out and speak. It's been very therapeutic to speak to young people that, and trying to prepare them that if this happens to you, what is available for you? And my wife was one of those self-isolated ones. And since I've started both organizations with Autism Speaks and the Student Campus Organization, she's come forward more and able to speak more about it and get more involved. And it's helped her a lot.
Can you mainstream a high-functioning autistic child in a school system with quote-unquote typical children?
Yes. Yeah. And that's one of the main focuses here in Rutherford County and Murfreesboro is they do what they call CDC classrooms, is they take the child, depending on the level of autism, and they place them in a typical classroom for so many hours a day. My son Joshua goes for 2 to 3 hours a day into a typical classroom to kind of get that social interaction. However, he is nonverbal, so he is not still participating in the class like my son Jacob is. Jacob goes to a typical classroom, but he receives external sources such as speech and occupational therapy outside of the classroom, but he is in a normal classroom with normal children.
Well, that is progress from when I was a child, because they would lump all the disabled mm-hmm. people from the wheelchair-bound to the mentally retarded into one special education classroom.
Yes.
With no differentiation, and one teacher had to know how to deal with each and every one of these young people, which is not fair to either to the student or the teacher.
No, it's not. And that's one of the things that we've encountered as parents of autistic children is we started out fighting for every service that we got for our children. Because special education, when you try to get funding for special education, or you try to get, it takes a lot of resources from the school to take care of a child. Now, if you put 10 or 15 in a school, they can't isolate every one of them, and they can't cater to every child. So it's been very difficult for the school systems, and I understand their stress, but you can understand the stress of the parents fighting for their child just to get the same services that a normal child would get. You know, and the call is going out right now. You know, I myself am trying in the state of Tennessee is trying to get the universities to start teaching these young adults in the education field, in the nursing department, in the behavioral sciences, in audiology and speech, specific areas of autism being taught in the school so that they know what they're going to encounter when they have these children and these young adults in the real world, how to treat them. And I think it's very well needed, and it needs to be started at universities.
Are we doing that now? Are we doing that in the curriculum?
Not currently. I'm not going to say I'm not working with the university to make that a change, but you know, anytime that you bring in a large curriculum of that nature, it takes several years to put the specialists together, to get the books together, to get the research together. So it takes a while. What we are trying to do is trying to get them to at least teach classes and not maybe necessarily a degree program in autism. I know of only two universities across the country right now that are teaching degree programs in autism, and they are in the graduate degree areas and not the undergraduate. But really, I think the need is in the undergrad area to get it spread across the community, because you're going to encounter, with one in 150 children, you're going to encounter an autistic person wherever you go.
Do the parents of autistic children blame themselves, say, what did I do? Did I not take enough folic acid when I was pregnant? Is there something wrong with my sperm? Do they blame their own biology?
Yes, and I think that part of the therapy of getting out and speaking, though, and finding out and researching whatnot helps take that blame away. I know my wife, and she's going to kill me for having said this, she was one of those people. She didn't want to talk about it. She blamed herself that it was something that she had done that caused this to our two sons. And now, having been involved with Autism Speaks and bringing out more of the science and the research efforts to it, she's starting to see that, you know, I'm not the only one. There are thousands upon thousands of parents that have autistic children. And I think one of the points that helped her is her very, very close cousin just had a son diagnosed on the autism spectrum. So now that she can see, okay, I'm not alone. I'm not the one that caused this. There's something in our environment. There's something, whether it be in inoculations, whether, you know, it's something that's going on in our environment that has caused this to our children, which Autism Speaks is also working on the research side, is to narrow down what those parameters are that are causing this.
With regard to the financial burden, what does it cost to take care of the special needs of an autistic child, and what kinds of resources are out there to help parents cope with the cost?
On average, through the lifetime of a child with autism, it roughly runs for therapies for that child, medications for that child, special clothing, special service, you know, special devices they may need. It averages about $50,000 per child. And I have two.
Over what time? Over a year?
That's over about the school age of the child.
Okay.
About $50,000. And that's if you have insurance. If you don't have any insurance, then you're a lot of out-of-pocket expenses. And right now, insurance does not pay for autism therapies. It pays for very, very little of any of the services they receive, because once the child reaches the age of three, it falls on the school system to provide the services for that child.
Do you have to buy special insurance for it?
There is nothing in existence yet, which is another thing that I'm trying to lead the charge on here in the state of Tennessee, is the insurance initiative, which 22 other states have introduced into theirs, and a handful have gotten it passed so far. The insurance initiative to bring it here will, if we can get it passed through Congress and through the state legislature, what it will do is start providing those families that are struggling with autism to get their therapies paid for. Because every time you take a child to a therapy outside of the school system, it costs money.
You can get cancer insurance, so there are these targeted types of insurance you can buy. One would think that we all know how widespread cancer is. One would think that with the increasing numbers that you're talking about, because that's what insurance companies look at, they go by actuarial tables, that the numbers would justify the fact that there is a market out there for this product that people need to buy.
You would think that, but however, I have not run into, and I have not experienced any, and I have never had an insurance man come forward to and tell me that there is such a thing that exists.
An issue related to autism that got a great deal of attention before Don Imus opened his big fat mouth and got kicked off the air, and justifiably so, is the issue of whether or not the use of the preservative thimerosal in the vaccines that are administered to children out of necessity before they go to school was a causal factor in autism, because thimerosal contains mercury, and one does not usually inject mercury into one's veins. What does the research say? Is there a definitive answer to this question?
Right now, I know Autism Speaks released a news article just this week saying that they're putting money into NIH, into that very research program, is to look to see if there is a connection with inoculations and mercury in the inoculations in our children. As a parent, having gone back through the medical records of my children and looked to see that my young children at the age of 6 months have received six shots in their young age, you have to question it. Is that a possibility? And the more and more people that I talk to, it seems that they are blaming inoculations on the autism symptoms in their children, just for the simple fact that, for that very reason, that there really is no other focus to go after. So I think, you know, being an advocate for autism, I have to say, my personal experience, I believe the inoculations are a cause. But being on the political advocate side, I can't say that is it, because every child is different, and, you know, every child's biology may just trigger through inoculations, might have triggered it. I can't say that for sure. I'm not a researcher, and I can't say definitively that, yes, that's what's causing it.
But if you raise more money for the research, you might be able to help the scientific community conduct the kind of research that would give you a definitive answer one way or the other.
Yes, that's one of the things that I believe most parents with autism that have children with autism are looking for. And that's probably why they do the fundraising so hard. And they want to know what's causing it. And then, though, autism is not reversible. So we're more or less doing self-preservation for those that come after us instead of what we're doing for ourselves. We want to know what caused it. We want to know how to get rid of it, kind of like what we would do with cancer. If you had a loved one that was diagnosed with cancer and died of cancer, you can't reverse it, but you can do something to prevent it from happening in the future.
If you were advising young couples, would you insist that their child get thimerosal-free vaccines when they go to get their shots, just as a precautionary measure?
If you can find a pediatrician or a medical doctor that's willing to give those, and they are few and far in between, I would. I've sought those out for my children for the last few years, just for that very reason. I mean, the step of caution, you can't go wrong, and you can't. You can't say if you're suspect of the inoculations, why keep doing it?
Are the thimerosal-free vaccines costlier or more difficult to find?
They are more costly, and they are harder to find, for the simple fact is the preservative that they use in them doesn't have a shelf life as long as the Thermosil does. So therefore, doctors and pediatricians don't keep them on hand as readily. You pretty much have to ask for them, pay whatever external cost it's going to take for them to get them. There are going to be some services that will have them, because a lot of pediatricians that will deal with children will have them readily on hand. But then, once again, that's the parent's search to find that particular doctor.
That sounds like a great deal of effort and a great deal of emotional stress, not unlike that of someone who is a full-time caregiver for an invalid loved one. How do you and your wife cope with the psychological strain?
Well, getting involved, staying involved, answering questions. Anybody that's willing to stop and ask me questions about it, I'm willing to talk to them about it. That's kind of my therapy and how I cope with it. It is a never-ending job. It's a 24/7. Even though raising children is a job in itself, you have to be fearful every time in a household, our oldest son now is able to unlock doors. So in the middle of the night, now you are fearing that, okay, did he get up and get out? You're constantly checking on him. You're worried about, okay, can he reach sharp objects? You're constantly in fear and
worry. Did he get into the liquor cabinet? Did he get into the gun cabinet? Did he get into the silverware drawer and get a butcher knife?
Exactly. And our older son has done exactly those things. And, you know, you've heard of child-proofing a house, but you know, it's nothing compared to autistic-proofing a house. And after a while, the child, you have to get him into routines. You have to get them to where they understand their parameters, where they can't go and they just can't absolutely do it. But, you know, the biggest fear is that they're going to get into an area, because the lack of fear is another area that most autistic children have. They just don't understand what fear is. So putting the hands on the burners, putting their hands in the open flame, stepping out into traffic is always a possibility with an autistic child. And it just scares my wife and I to death. So, yeah, we're constantly within an arm's reach of our children at all times. And you'll find that with most autistic families is they are within eyesight and arm reach of their autistic child because, you know, and it's nerve-wracking. You can see all the gray hair on my head, and I can't say that it all happened just this year, but, you know, it has been a very, very stressful life with two autistic children.
Do you have a fence around your yard?
Yes, I do.
You had to, didn't you?
Yes. I have the one in the backyard, which we allow them to go into the backyard, but never alone. We're always with them. We if they go out front to wait on the bus for school, we're always with them. You can't allow them not be alive themselves, because you hear every day, you're hearing more and more in the stories of children wandering off on hiking expeditions that are autistic. They just don't have that fear factor in there, so they don't understand what's out there that can harm them.
What do parents of autistic children do when they run into conflicts with their employers who maybe don't offer flex time or telecommuting or the kinds of family-friendly policies that would enable them to be there for their children in the event of an emergency?
You know, I can't really speak for my wife and I, because I have to say my wife's employer has been outstanding in that field. He has allowed her to take several days that's been needed when we have appointments at Vanderbilt, or, you know, we have a child that's sick that's in the hospital. Because when you want an experience, take an autistic child to the hospital and have to stay there for days, that's an experience in itself, and it requires the parents to be there at all times. But I'm sure there are several parents out there that have run into that issue of you know, having to switch job to job because their employers just didn't understand what was going on with them and their autistic child. One of my biggest sayings is, you never understand what's happening until it happens to you. And that's where we find a lot more employers and friends and adults and people within the community that start understanding it's because they have a connection somewhere. Because 1 in 150, remember, you can almost go everywhere and find one everywhere.
The group is called Students for Autism Awareness. It is an officially acknowledged and certified student organization on the campus of MTSU. And if people want to know more about it, how do they get in touch?
Well, they can go onto the student organization website through MTSU's website and find the student organizations. We are listed there under service organizations. They can find me on the campus anywhere. You can almost always see I'm wearing some autistic specific shirt, hat, pin, something of that nature. Or if you see someone on the campus wearing a puzzle piece, stop and ask them, because I can almost guarantee you they are a parent or a friend of an autistic child, and they can tell you. But most cases, go onto the student organization website, find us, and it gives you a direct link to myself and to our student faculty advisor, who is Professor Jennifer Cates.
Do you have an email address or a telephone number?
Yes, my email address on campus is edevans@mtsu.edu.
All together.
Yes.
Ed Evans, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loke. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. We're also available in podcast form at mtsunews.com, and we're on iTunes.